This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, after a trio of draws at the beginning of 2026, Manchester City got back into the saddle with a record-breaking home win over Exeter on Saturday and then a battling victory at Newcastle on Tuesday. Double figures in the FA Cup was followed by a hard-fought and well-earned two-goal lead in the first leg of the League Cup semi-final. So we'll discuss both of those games on today's show, including the fourth longest VAR delay in English football history. Oh boy, are we coming to that. It's potentially another tricky week coming up too. City have to cross the Manchester border to get to Old Trafford, and then they're off to the Arctic Circle to face Bodo Glimt. One's a dark, devastating, cold, hostile place, and the other is the Arctic Circle. Previews of those games coming up with Jay Mottershead from the Stretford Paddock and from the Norwegian journalist Stian Hoogland. Let's get to it all. I'm David Mooney. With me this week is City fan Chris Higginbottom.
I hope you're right.
And from Sporting News, Dom Farrell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. I mean, there is only one place to start, really. What's the most ridiculous delay you've ever encountered? Dom, is there anything that's really kept you waiting for absolutely no reason whatsoever?
I was scratching my head about this. This is maybe fairly mundane, but I once had about a four-hour delay for a flight to Dublin, which for the amount of time you're actually in the air seemed ridiculous.
Feels like you can get to Dublin in that 4 hours,
yeah,
doesn't it?
could have had a swim. No, it was on a stag do as well that I was, unfortunately for the stag, I was best manning. But yeah, when we were, because it was delayed, and then we had to go, went on the plane, there's another delay, and waiting on the tarmac. And I went, this is ridiculous. Why don't you just let us back into the airport to have a drink? And then, like, while you were saying that, the penny dropped of, yeah, probably not a great idea to let people at the bar for 4 hours and then try and herd them back onto a plane. So yeah, big up to Ryanair.
Yeah. Higgy, any ridiculous delays?
Well, I mean, if we're doing it chronologically, I was an emergency cesarean because it was like 2 weeks overdue, so probably the first one of note. I
fear
also,
this may be a long list if that's where we're starting.
Yeah, up until present day, I was once got thrown into a lift by some bouncers in Leeds in like the mid 90s for no other reason than being from Manchester. That's the short version. And they knew that the lift was faulty, pressed down on the lift because it was in the elbow rooms on like the first or second floor, old pool hall. I don't know if it still exists. Hopefully not.
It does actually, mate.
Oh, does it? Well, I wonder if the lift works, because at the time when they pressed it, it went down by about 4 feet and then juddered to a halt with my eyes at like floor level on the floor I'd just been thrown out of. And I was in there for about 4-5 hours.
This about the time of a delay on a flight to Dublin, is what you're saying?
Well, yeah, I could have probably got to Dublin under normal circumstances if I'd not been in the lift. But, yeah, basically I was like hammering, banging on this lift. It was the days before everyone had phones. I didn't have one. So nobody knew where I was. I missed my train home, had to get an emergency bus because the train, when I eventually got to the station, had been cancelled. Fell asleep on the bus, woke up at Manchester Airport. It wasn't a fun evening.
So elbow rooms on TripAdvisor has an average of 2 stars.
Well, that's too high, too many for me. I was in there that long, I had to tear open the lift doors by as much as I could, which was about, I don't know, 4 inches. And actually wee down the lift shaft because I've not been dragged up. I didn't want to do that in the lift. And the only way I eventually got out, because there was customers coming up the stairs and they were like, there's a guy trapped in this lift. What's going on there? Like, and the bouncers came and like said, will you shut up? And I was like, no, you've thrown me in a lift. I said, is the engineer coming? Yeah, he's on his way. And I'm like, where from? And they said, like, London, and started laughing. And I'm like, surely 4 burly Yorkshiremen can open this lift door and like bust me out of here. And appealing to their more brutish instincts, that seemed to do the trick, and they wrenched it open, and out I flew and then ran down the stairs. Not wholly dissimilar from the first delay situation, if you think about it.
let's move away from the nonsense and get back to the football. Dom, turns out we were saying on last week's show, we didn't know if these cups were a good distraction given given the form that or the results that City have had in the league. Turns out very good distractions.
Yeah, my nana always used to say, you're better off out of these cup competitions, which is mad given, like...
She didn't like football.
Yeah.
No, on the contrary. So she was like, she was very much into the football when City were winning the cup with Bert. When City used to win cups, I don't know. That seemed to put her off them. But yeah, I'm afraid her logic is flawed, and it was a very good week.
Those cup competitions up their old tricks again.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're better off in them and winning them would be my view on it. Yeah.
Not a wholly controversial view, really, I would suspect.
It's quite mainstream, yeah. I'm all
No,
for
no.
It's
I mean, my nana's viewpoint of, like, after watching Bert Trautmann's heroics, dicing with death to win the FA Cup and gone, do you know what? I'm not sure about this.
Is it worth
strange position to take. But yeah, really good. Very contrasting games. Good fun knockabout against Exeter, I guess. And then after that, probably the best, I mean, inverted commas, the best proper performance of the season, I think, in all departments, safe to say.
Yeah, Higgy, the I was going to say, in terms of kind of the mood around the place and how kind of we as fans are feeling, like I, you look at the performances again in those three draws, you know, Sunderland, Chelsea, Brighton, the performances were kind of okay to good. And you can take that positive, but you don't get the result at the end of it. Like, just the absolute battering that Exeter took. And then the performance at Newcastle, combined with the fact that they've won the game, clean sheet, last minute goal to kind of, you know, just add the icing on the top there. All of that just really picks the mood up, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, and it needed picking up. I mean, like you say, the draws, I mean, they are what they are. We should have won, but for a few, you know, glaring, unforgivable season-defining misses, we'll let that go. We did all we could. So, yeah, Exeter, a welcome boon. And just to get 10, I mean, it was great. I took my... I went with my mate and his son, my godson, who's not been for a while, and to let him see 10 goals was fantastic, and being able to go home to my boy and say, "City scored 10! You know, because normally you ask a child of that age and 10's like a random number they will come up with as a prediction. So to actually...
For it to actually happen.
Yeah, to be able to follow through on that's pretty good. But the Newcastle game, like, yeah, it was a proper gritty, ballsy performance all over the park. Everybody really showed what they were made of. I was particularly impressed with Bernardo. Especially for me, the thing that really got me about him was that in the previous game, especially the Brighton one, he was seemingly to me clearly targeted as someone to wind up. He was guarding our penalty spot like it was like the Holy Grail or something. And I don't even think they did want to scuff it up that much, to be honest. I think they could see that he would be wound up by them appearing to want to scuff it up, so they were just pulling his levers and he was biting every time, got booked for it. I mean, winning a penalty and getting booked is a bit daft, isn't it? And they were trying that, the Newcastle team tried it on with him and he resisted it absolutely admirably.
Gave it back in many ways, yeah.
Well, yeah, but he gave it back in the right way rather than, you know, snipe. You know, he was within the laws of the game the way he kind of made up for what they were trying to do, and you got people like Joe Linton throwing his considerable heft around the place, but yeah, I thought they were mainly all of them fantastic.
The thing to mention about Newcastle as well, Dom, is that a lot of that game, well, for an hour of that game, it was with Nico O'Reilly as the number six, the holding midfielder. And if you'd have said at the start of the week they're going to go to Newcastle with one of only Rodri or Nico in there, you'd have gone, okay, it'll be a tough game anyway. Then you see the starting lineup drop and neither of them are in there, and you're thinking, okay, well, this will be tough now. And then you look at what O'Reilly did; he was just good.
Yeah, everyone's going to get Porto flashbacks at that point, aren't they? And forever will do. But as we mentioned, how good Bernardo was. He, like, absolutely universally praised performance, apart from one notable exception that some people might have
seen. Yes.
yeah, but I seem to remember Bernardo doing an interview, would have been a couple of years ago, I think now, where he said he did a mix zone with someone after the game at the Etihad, and he got asked, like, what's his favourite position, because Pep sort of plays him everywhere, much to everyone's chagrin, he plays him often on the right wing. But he said his favourite position is next to the defensive midfielder, which is what he did at Newcastle, and he did it brilliantly. And I think having him there playing like that just makes everybody's job easier. I mean, that's not to downplay how well Nico O'Reilly played. I thought there was a brief sort of period, sort of a little bit after, sort of after the first 10 minutes, where it looked like City was struggling to get out a bit, and you wonder, is that because it's a young defence and an inexperienced holding midfielder player in there? But I guess there's the point of view that if we look at what, because Nico O'Reilly played that role, like, when he first came in the team at the start of last season a couple of times, but the experience of playing fullback for City now for the best part of a year is you do so many of those holding midfielder things anyway. And yeah, it was a really nice... I mean, obviously, we're well aware that the kid's fantastic, but just proper seeing him footballer. Play... Yeah, just seeing him play that position for the first time in... Well, I mean, I think he maybe played there against Spurs in the League Cup last year, will be the last time. And seeing, like, how much the time at fullback has brought him on in the position that I think we all expect he's going to end up in eventually was great to see.
In terms of kind of the performance of the week as well, Higgy, I mean, you talk about the Exeter game and the personnel in there. The lineup was probably stronger than many of us anticipated it was going to be, but still, it was rotated and there was a good number of younger players kind of given their opportunities, or fringe players given their opportunities. And I know it, again, comes with the caveat of it being against, you know, aside from League One, but it was a really... kind of, it was a comfortable performance that then leads to Newcastle. And you look at the rotation options City had there, like Rico Lewis coming off the bench, like players that maybe weren't in Guardiola's thinking recently, and now, like, this week kind of come back into it, haven't they?
Yeah, and power to them. You've got to take your opportunity when it comes. It's a bit weird that one, that he played Haaland and that Haaland didn't score, and then he said he wanted Marmoush to come back because Haaland was knackered. I was like, well, yeah, he could have kind of negated that. But yeah, the players that came in, I thought Lewis did well. I do worry about Lewis in terms of him coming on, and if there's a situation where a game needs turning into our favour, is he the guy, is he the go-to guy for that? When we're doing well and he comes on, he's very, very, you know, more than capable of being a cog in that already well-oiled, smooth-running machine. There's a lot of doubt over his future, and it's a shame because I really like him and I think he's a good footballer and he can play in a variety of positions, but I just don't know if that sort of elite level is going to be ultimately beyond him in this at this club. I don't know. Very impressed with... I thought Mukaidu, for me, possibly man of the match. I thought he was absolutely brilliant. Everything he did was really positive. He was brave, and what he tried came off. And if it didn't, it didn't put him off, and he stuck to his task. I thought it was fantastic.
Great goal as well.
Yeah, definitely, exactly. I must admit, I listened to the podcast that previewed the Exeter game, and yeah, it was pretty... I felt sorry for the... sort of retrospectively sorry for the Exeter guy. He goes, yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be a case of he'll set up and there'll be nodding balls away. And if we can get to, you know, half time at a reasonable score, you just never know if we forget the first goal. And it's like, yeah, okay. Well, that didn't quite work out, did it? But
All of that was true. It just didn't work out. Yeah.
Yeah. And to be fair to them, I think they scored the goal of the game, didn't they? Mm.
But I mean, the other. I mean, where do you want to? I'll let you decide this, Dom, because there's two major talking points really for this week. We could go into the VAR delay right now, or we could go into the 10 goals. Which would you rather do?
Can we do 10 goals? And I know we've got to do VAR, but it's... I mean, and I'm sure we'll bring great levity to it, but God, it's fucking boring, isn't it?
Okay, 10 goals first.
Further bit of your soul gets drained away each time it's mentioned or experienced.
Yeah, well, we'll save that for a bit later on because... So, Dom, first time double figures since November 87. Oddly enough, first time in my lifetime. I was born kind of... I was born, I think it was 4 days after the Huddersfield game. as we said, some nice goals in there. Elaine and Semenyo's first goals, Rodri with a belter, Makedo on his debut, Rico Lewis with a double. Like in terms of kind of actually seeing that happen, it's kind of a generational thing.
Yeah, I mean, so I was 15 months old for the Huddersfield game. Didn't bother going, part-timer. I think I saw it. I mean, I'm sure Adam Carter can fact-check me here, but there's a weird thing that wasn't the Huddersfield game also 4-0 at half-time and also they got their one at 9-0? Which is
in the 90th minute as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of spooky, isn't it? And I think, so obviously having watched that video as well, like seeing those goals back with the Stuart Adcock and White hat tricks, there's like the crowd noise for Rico Lewis's for the 10th goal is very similar to the 10th against Huddersfield. It's like it's sort of noise you're not quite. It's like proper giddiness of it's going to be 10. It's like that, cause I was one of my mates on WhatsApp was going, you've beaten team 7 and 8 lows. You know, who cares? But 10's a thing to do, and it's like, you're right, it really is. And
I'm very annoyed, you know, that because when my season ticket kept going up and up and up a few years ago, I dropped out of the cup schemes one by one. League Cup first, FA Cup second, Champions League third, and now I pick and choose my games. And I didn't pick this one, so I didn't go. And I wasn't in the ground when they scored 10.
Maybe I took umbrage to the junior blues pricing policy when I was 0 years old. I don't know. Maybe that's why I wasn't at Huddersfield.
Yeah.
I think I was 10 and I didn't go, so yeah. Did you see it mess the scoreboard up a bit?
Yeah, it was a bit out of line, wasn't it?
The zero kind of encroached onto the next field on the because obviously for some reason don't expect that to happen all the time, which is
I like stuff like that. Yeah. I did actually shout out to Adam Carter and Stat City Dom because he sent me a load of info that I could work some stuff out because there were 2006 games between the two 10-1 victories that City have had, which means roughly in terms of football played, not including added time and things like that, but it means roughly 125 days, 9 hours of football has been played between the two times where City scored 10 in a game. 3,636 goals were scored in that time between them, with 248 different scorers in that in the period between. And I also spotted this, which I wish I'd made more of at the time. But 10-1 on the 10th of January, 10th of the 1st. And it's the 18th time that the final score of a City game has matched the date.
Very nice.
Thank you for that.
Most of them, five of them, were 1-1 draws on New Year's Day. The latest one in the year, Higgy, I think you might have talked about this one in the past.
Don't ask me to remember something. But,
well, yeah, we'll try. Oldham 2, City 5 on the 2nd of May. 1992.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember.
Can't remember why we talked about AD that. Mike, I think we talked about
I
that.
I think AD Mike scored in that game. I do remember it. Lovely maroon kit. And yeah.
What great wasn't day. That in the era when Boundary Park's pitch like basically you wouldn't take grass as well? It's like the highest football ground in England, but it was also a beach.
Yeah.
So it's so high up every time you throw grass seed down it just blows away.
Yeah,
very much so.
Well, yeah. And there's a significant game during that time as well, which should have been 10. Let's not forget,
indeed. Four of the other games where the final score matches the date have come under Guardiola. 2-1 against Burnley in his first season on the 2nd of January 2017. 4-1 against Port Vale in 2020 on the 4th of January. And 4-1 against West Ham last season on the 4th of January as well. I don't know why I noticed these things, Dom.
Yeah, I wish that Port Vale one had been 10-1 because it was that absolute chopper played up front for them, that Tom Pope, wasn't it? The one who was like...
Oh, yeah.
Who was calling out John Stones and Benjamin Mendy thought that was really funny. So, you know, maybe he found a kindred spirit there, I don't know. But yeah, I thought he was an absolute joke of a plumber of a footballer and I wish we'd won by many more goals.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with being a plumber, by the way.
No, there's nothing wrong with a plumber. They're essential if you have
noble trade.
Those sort of, yeah, absolutely. But it's very much the magic of the cup, the tradesmen, the IT consultants, the milkmans, all of that jazz. What fair play to Macclesfield, by the way. That was great.
Yeah. Shared them at Palace.
made their central defender look a bit cack, if I might say.
Yeah.
Forget the name.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Please give us your backing. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
The VAR delay is something that we have to talk about as well from the Newcastle game. And Higgy, this is the fourth longest it's taken VAR to come to a decision in England, taking 5 minutes, 30 seconds. I had a little bit of a scout around. In that time, you could have listened to the UK's shortest number one single 3.5 times. That was What Do You Want by Adam Faith from 1959. Must admit, not familiar with the song.
A goal, Adam. We want a goal.
Yeah. You could have watched the pre-title sequence from one of 7 James Bond films, from Russia with Love, Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Live and Let Die, Thunderball, Diamonds Are Forever, or Goldfinger. All of them have shorter pre-title sequences than 5 minutes 30. According to BBC Good Food, you could boil an egg in 5 minutes 30, if you, as long as you like them with a set white and a
ostrich
runny yolk.
All right.
Yeah. And you could also watch Ronnie O'Sullivan's 1997 World Championship 147 break. That was
that's remarkable. That's amazing. Yeah,
that, he made that 147 in a quicker time than it took the VAR to come to a decision on on Tuesday night. You could also, if you really wanted to, have put on City's comeback win against Aston Villa and watched all 3 goals from 2-0 down on the final day. All 3 of those goals came in a quicker time period than it did than it took them to disallow that goal. So, with all of that in mind, what are your thoughts on that delay?
I mean, I guess if to start with, the good news is that Ryan Cherki goal wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for all that injury time. And I think that everyone's big fear was that that was going to get their crowd up so much that it would make it difficult. And I think just after the restart, was it Nunes who just like blammed one straight up in the air? And then there was Tonali had that shot and you're thinking,
it swung the game, this.
This has really done them there. But after that, they were exemplary. I guess having Rodri on by that point, as good as Nico Reilly was, having Rodri on there just to be the grown-up next to Bernardo really helped. But I know you've referenced a lot on this show, and he is the authority on it, which, I mean, bless him, I'm sure he didn't choose this. But Dale Johnson, formerly ESPN, now the BBC, was getting a bit of stick because he was saying that technically it is, you know, it's correct what they've done. But this is the problem, that it just wasn't brought in for this, was it?
No. Well, here's let me outline what the decision is, because I've been through what the decision is. So it's a subjective offside, because it's not whether or not Haaland is in an offside position. He is in an offside position. It's whether he's active or not. The line was drawn from Nick Pope because he's the second last defender. The goalkeeper's gone beyond the last defender, so he's become the second last defender. The semi-automated offside technology failed because there were too many bodies in the way there, so the VAR had to draw lines. That added to the delay. Haaland was deemed to have interfered with the defender's ability to play the ball, not Nick Pope's ability to make the save, but the defender's ability to play the ball. They are wrestling with each other. The laws of the game make no allowances for the defender wrestling Haaland if Haaland is offside. Offside takes precedence in that run of events. And it also doesn't matter in the law whether or not the defender could have reacted to the ball. It's just whether Haaland has impacted his ability to do so. So if that ball was blasted into the net by Semenyo from an inch in front of the defender, it does not matter if Haaland is still impacting his decision, his ability to play the ball, because he is there in an offside position.
So could it be deemed he's impacting his ability to play the ball because he's there being wrestled?
Yes, right? Yes, it can. And that's ultimately what the decision is.
You're standing there being fouled, so we're going to penalise you for it.
Basically, I mean, that's what the decision's been given for. And when you kind of look through what the laws of the game say, it's like the Marcus Rashford one at Old Trafford. You can make a number of cases. Nothing's like it, I know. No. But you can look at each one of those law, each one of the kind of the clauses in the law, and say, well, this doesn't really apply. This doesn't really apply. This doesn't really apply. Therefore, the outcome has to be this. But actually, as Dom, as you were saying there, it doesn't really feel right for what it's for, does it?
I think the Rashford one is outright a lot worse. Because one thing I would say, and this is like where the VAR conversation is so maddening and it's just draining, is if that goal had been allowed to stand, you can bet your bottom dollar there would have been triads all over TalkSport the next morning saying how it was offside. Mm. How's Haaland not interfering with play?
What's people would have done that. The Chinese mafia.
there is so much bad faith, bad Adam faith involved in this.
What do you want?
So yeah, exactly. Yeah, but this is yeah, and what do you want is actually maybe a good question, because people were sold this idea of officiating perfection, and I've no doubt. I mean, FIFA and UEFA do this every year. They show that they have a slightly higher percentage of correct decisions. Of course, they do. Is anybody happy? Has that made anybody's life better? And I'm not. I know some listeners to this and David's other podcast will be aware that Sam Lee is VAR's a load of bullshit. Hate it. I was very much a pro VAR guy, but Jesus, it's jumped the shark, hasn't it? I mean, yeah, no doubt. When you crunch the numbers at the end of the year, there is, you know, we had 92% correct decisions. Now it's up to 95%. Who gives a shite? No one before VAR would have said that was offside in a month of Sundays.
Has it made?
But we're now in a situation whereby if you go to VAR, they probably have to disallow it. It doesn't have to take 5.5 minutes, but that's because Stuart Atwell's career is a comic ongoing sequence of incompetence, and yet he still is here and we still have to look at him on team sheets. Fine. You know, no one would have disallowed that before VAR. Now you're in a situation where because of all the rules and laws around VAR, you pretty much have to disallow it. And that is just not making anybody's life any better.
This is it. Has it made football better? No. Has it made football worse? Yes. You look at the FA Cup games over the weekend, they were much better for not having VAR. The sort of honesty and purity of the reactions that you were able to engage in. I mean, yes, you know, Liverpool should have had a penalty against them and they didn't get it, and it would have delayed the game for a couple of minutes for VAR to suggest that it wasn't a penalty as well, even though it was. That was perhaps one incident, but you know, that would have happened anyway. So yeah, just sack it off, put us out of our misery.
Higgy, does it stick in the craw a little bit when you then watch the second semi-final and see effectively the same sort of incident happen, but because of the delay the night before and everyone going, well, this, like, it shouldn't take this long, effectively the opposite decision has been come to?
It's just just garnishes the farce, doesn't it? It just exacerbates how shit it is. It doesn't bother me. I expect it to get worse, and I expect it to be more ridiculous, and I expect it to be annoying, and so it proves. So it's just, of course that happened. It's just perfect, really.
Yeah. I guess the other comparison, Dom, as well, is the Liverpool disallowed goal at the Etihad earlier this season where Andy Robertson ducked out of the way of the ball, and he was deemed interfering with Donnarumma's ability to make the save. And again, that's a good illustration of whether or not the goalkeeper could have made the save or not, because the judgment isn't could Donnarumma have made that save, it's was his ability to make the save impacted by Robertson being there, and the answer has to be yes because of him ducking out the way of the ball. Now, the decision that day was given offside on field, so at least there was some element of this has been seen in real time. Absolutely nobody on that pitch, no Newcastle defender, no City forward, no official, was suspicious of an offside until the VAR watched it back.
There is and this doesn't necessarily apply to the City Newcastle one, because I think everyone agrees that it's just a goal and it's bollocks. But this idea that nothing been given on the field, but you have this idea of giving sort of primacy to try and stick with the referee's call. It's like the umpire's call thing in cricket. I get that everyone thinks that is good sense, but I feel like there's been an increasing aspect this season. Doku's penalty against Brighton is a prime example of this, where referees are sometimes a bit hesitant and think, well, the VAR can bail them out. Now, the Doku one was such a laughably obvious Stonewall penalty, then it was fine. But what if that's a bit marginal and the basically the on-field ref has sort of bottled the decision a little bit, but because we're doing a high bar, that then can't
the
be
the VAR goes, that's not enough for me to get involved. Reasonably, it's a penalty, yeah.
The high bar assumes an authoritative decision. So yeah, that's one thing. And the other thing that I think is the fallacy at the heart of all of this. I just mentioned cricket, and I'm a big cricket fan, and technology has massively improved decision-making on that sport. But cricket is a very stop-start sport with lots of specific rules and lots of repeatable situations throughout a game. The beauty of football and why football is the most popular sport in the world is there isn't any of that rigmarole. It's because outside of a few things of, you know, the line is there, what is a goal and isn't a goal, so much of it is subjective interpretation. People go, all we want is consistency. Well, okay, but true consistency in football officiating, because of the nature of the game, is impossible. But the nature of the game also makes it the most popular sport in the world. So it's like they've looked at the way technology works in cricket, rugby league, tennis and whatever and gone, oh, we want that. But you actually don't, because what those sports don't have is being what football is to everybody. Mm. So, yeah, just accept that there's going to be some nonsense decisions. And if you were to, in this sort of perfect world I think we all want now, that you sack it all off and stick with goal line technology tomorrow, let's ban having an hour of talking to Dermot Gallagher about everything, because that's shit. Absolute rubbish. You know, except there will be a mistake. Because before VAR, it was like going over all referee decisions in minutiae. It's like there's going to be mistakes because it's baked into a game that is so open and chaotic and why we all love it. I mean, I'm not saying you've got to love mistakes. Obviously, it's frustrating. It's part of it. But this is not better. This is just not better.
Yeah, well, we've mentioned the Rashford decision at Old Trafford. That's where City go next. So hopefully nothing as nonsensical as that happens at the weekend. But let's start with previewing that game by getting a view from United. I've been speaking to Jay Mottershead from the Stretford Paddock, starting with the new man in the dugout for Saturday's game.
I don't say it very often about Manchester United, and it's not something they deserve credit for because they've kind of got us into this mess. But this appointment makes sense to me. Michael Carrick, to the end of the season, it does make a lot of sense. I think it's a logical move. Look, we all have an emotional attachment to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. We've got an emotional attachment to Michael Carrick, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, that iconic goal in the new camp, the fact that when he came in as manager, there were some sort of brief highs there for a time when we were challenging you guys for the title. And I think it was New Year's Day when we were top of the league. I know it didn't last, but there was a time when, you know, we looked, thought we could be in here with a shot, and a third place finish and a second place finish as well isn't too shabby, certainly not compared to what else has gone on at Manchester United post Alex Ferguson. So Ollie would have been an appointment that I think would have sort of tugged on the heartstrings a little bit. Oh yeah, maybe unfinished business and all the rest of it. But Michael Carrick is probably the logical step. He's managed the club before, albeit only briefly, but he knows what it's like to be in the United dugout as a United manager, even though it's only three games. Those three games, I know it's a very small sample size, but he did well in them. You know, he got us into the Champions League knockout stages with that win over Villarreal, beat Arsenal to get us into the top four and got a point away at Stamford Bridge. So it was a decent little mini spell. And as a player, similar to Ollie, he's very well respected. I don't use the word legend lightly. I think sometimes we bandy that about, especially us content creators. We can say legend about anyone who'll talk to us who's played for our clubs, if we're being honest. I've introduced a few ex-players as legends and thought, well, okay. But Michael Carrick is. He's won everything. Won multiple league titles, Champions League. I think he's one of the few players that's won every single club trophy you can win. And I like the way he carries himself. He's been a coach at the club as well under Ollie for a number of years he was. And I think when he went to Middlesbrough, even though it wasn't great because he ended up getting sacked, he did take them at one point from 21st to 4th into the playoffs, which was a very good run. And they were mid-table, so it wasn't like it was a disastrous spell. They just didn't quite kick on the way they hoped they would. So it makes sense. Get him into the end of the season and then look for a permanent manager, but then appoint a permanent manager. It's a sort of a logical move. I just feel a bit sorry for Michael Carrick because his first couple of games, I think, are some club called Manchester City. I don't know much about them. And another one called, I think, Arsenal as well, away. So I don't know much about them either. So, yeah, there's 6 points in the bank
So I'm interested how you feel about kind of where the journey's going and where it's been and everything like that, because like there was talk that it would be Ole Gunnar Solskjaer back in the dugout, and I found myself thinking, how's it come to this? Because it's kind of like you're moving on from Solskjaer, and then you appoint Ten Hag, you have the seasons under him. Ruben Amorim comes in with this big master plan, and then that hasn't worked. And you kind of like the options again now just seem to be some ex-players. And I just kind of like, I kind of wonder where things are going and how you're feeling about it all.
I just don't see any progress, to be honest with you. I think that we're in the sort of similar situation, if not worse situation, than we were when Ineos took over. I was hoping that Ineos were going to come in and make decisions that move this football club forward. Now, they came in and automatically they said, look, we're going to put the right people in the right positions. We're going to get the best in class, I think is what Sir Jim Ratcliffe said. He spoke about putting football people in football positions, which you think, well, any club will do that. But United, we weren't doing that. We had people like Ed Woodward, who's a banker, in charge of football decisions. He didn't know anything about football. That Richard Arnold came from a rugby background and he was put in charge of things as well. So, when they said those things, it made sense to me and I was looking forward to seeing them do it. However, there's been a lot of missteps and,
I was going to say, have they done that?
No. Well, they've paid lip service to it. On the surface, it looks like they have. But then you look at the decisions that have been made and whether they've worked out. And I'll just run through some of them with you. And you can tell me whether you think these are good decisions or not. They came in and Ten Hag was the manager. We won the FA Cup final. Obviously, beat you guys in the final, which is a massive game for us. Everyone was buzzing. They started interviewing replacements for Erik ten Hag almost at the final whistle. As soon as that game ended, they started speaking to the likes of Thomas Tuchel, Thomas Frank, one or two others as well, as a successor to Erik ten Hag. For whatever reason, decided not to appoint anyone else, even though Erik ten Hag knew they were looking at other managers, kept Erik ten Hag for the next 3 months, gave him a new deal, then sacked him, brought in Dan... I've not finished yet. It gets worse. Well, probably better for you as a City fan. You're loving this. During this time as well, we paid compensation to Newcastle to get Dan Ashworth, their director of football, I think his title was, from them. We had to wait a few months because he was on gardening leave and they dug the reels in and said, you're not having him before July. So we waited for him till July. We paid him compensation to get him. We then, when we sat Ten Hag, had a shortlist. He didn't agree with that. He didn't want us to get Ruben Amorim. Apparently, he wanted someone with Premier League experience. So rather than listen to him, we sacked him, got rid of Dan Ashworth after paying that money to get him, had to give him a big payout. Ruben Amorim comes in, a manager who's well known, and you'll know it as a City fan because you played against him in the Champions League. He likes the 3-4-2-1 formation. That's his formation. That's what he won 2 titles at Sporting Lisbon with. That is what he is pretty dogmatic about. We let him do that for a bit, and then we say, right, we want you to change your formation. And when he says, not really too keen on that, we then have the likes of Jason Wilcox, someone else you'll know, Sir Jim Ratcliffe saying, well, you've got him. He says he don't want him. You see that press conference at Leeds after the Leeds game where he's more or less saying, look, I might not be Jose Mourinho or Thomas Tuchel or Antonio Conte, but I am the manager of this football club, not the head coach. And that basically, I'm going to do what I think is right. And they sack him.
Do you think that's the right decision to get rid of him? Or would you have preferred that they were to back him and go in the direction that he wanted to go?
I think after that press conference, his position was untenable. Mm. I honestly think he sacked himself, basically. I don't think his heart was in it at United. I think after the Grimsby game, you could see it. And if you watch a lot of Ruben Amorim press conferences, and I don't expect you to, because why would you as a City fan? But I used to watch them all. And there was a lot of times where after the game, he'd be emotional, especially after the deflating result. He'd say things, United are the worst. This is the worst United team ever. These players show me what they're about with that performance against Grimsby. And then the following press conference, the pre-match press conference for the next game, he'd backtrack a bit. And he'd say, well, I say things, I say I hate the players. I say I hate my family sometimes. I say it's the worst United team. Well, I just meant statistically. He'd sort of backtrack and you think, this is a guy that's living on the edge a little bit. He's very emotional. He's obviously been sort of surprised at the task of the role and all that comes with being a Manchester United manager and probably the level of the players as well. He probably thought that he was going to inherit a team and a squad that was a lot stronger than it was. We saw what happened with the likes of Garnacho. We saw what happened with the likes of Jadon Sancho and Antony and Marcus Rashford. Marcus Rashford, one in particular, who scored the first goal for Ruben Amorim in the Ruben Amorim era, if you can call it that. And yet, ends up getting dropped for the Manchester Derby from the squad, not featuring in the squad for seven games, and then going out on loan to Barcelona, well, Sevilla, then Barcelona. It was just obvious that Ruben Amorim was, got Erik ten Hag on the brain, that Ruben Amorim was just not feeling it as Manchester United manager. And I think that came to the front there with that Leeds press conference where Jason Wilcox, according to what we'd heard, had been sort of in his ear about changing the tactics, changing the formation. This system became a big stick to beating with. Three at the back, it wasn't working. United finished 15th, lost the cup final to Spurs, and then were, you know, ended up 10, 11 points, whatever, behind Aston Villa. He changed it for the Newcastle game. We got a win. He went to four at the back. Then for the Leeds game, he changes it back to, or for the Wolves game, sorry, he changes it back to three at the back, or five at the back, if you want to count the wing-backs as defenders. And it caused a bit of a storm. Because, you know, Wolves are statistically one of the worst Premier League teams ever, if not the worst.
On track to be the worst, aren't they? Yeah,
they're doing the best. So I do sympathise with him in the sense that if you're the manager, you should be able to pick the formation and the team. Even if I don't agree with that team and don't agree with that formation, I understand that as the United manager, he has to make that decision. Not Sir Jim Ratcliffe, not Jason Wilcox. And it was obviously, he felt it was being taken out of his hands and he didn't stand for it. And he made that clear. He didn't want to quit. So I think if you quit, you lose your compensation. His coaching staff would have lost all their payoff as well. He obviously brought them with him and wanted them and himself to get the payoff. So he made it, he got it to a position where they couldn't have kept him on. I don't think, and I've said this a few times, I don't think United could have let Ruben Amorim have another press conference as United manager because the guy was ready to say anything. He really was. He wasn't pulling his punches. And I thought, look, they probably looked at it and thought, we cannot keep this guy on. We cannot let him get in front of a camera again because he's already sort of going rogue and he's not feeling it. So I think we need to call it a day. And that's what they've done.
Yeah.
Football-wise, it wasn't great. I kind of get it, but I felt like this was a decision based more on that press conference that was the final straw rather than the result at Leeds.
Yeah. So there's the as you say, football's not been great. There's been a lot of turmoil behind the scenes. Now Carrick's in, Manchester Derby on Saturday. How are you feeling about this game? How do you think they'll approach it?
It's weird because there's a part of it, like, look, the obvious answer to that question is United lose. City are sort of flying in a title race again, United in turmoil, well off it. Michael Carrick's only going to have about 2 days with the players ahead of that game. What can he do? But there's a part of me that feels sometimes
Derby, though, isn't it? Yeah.
Derby, you write us off and, you know, we can pull the odd result out. We did it under Ruben Amorim at the Etihad last season. We did it in that FA Cup final, the second one against you guys under Ten Hag, when everyone thought, well, this is going to be a repeat of the first one, and we managed to get a result. And I think we were good value for that result as well. Mm. So you can do it. We can get a result against Manchester City. And even last season, I think at Old Trafford, everyone thought we were struggling and we were near the bottom. I think we got a 0-0. I'm not exactly going to get the bunting out for getting a 0-0. But
I think both of us settled for a 0-0 that day, didn't we?
Yeah, we did, didn't we? It's a bit of a weird derby. That wasn't a blood and thunder derby, that one, was it?
No.
It was
kind of like... Not a classic, I think they call them.
No, yeah. I often forget that one. Genuinely, when people say, like, we drew with City. And I'm like, did we? Oh, yeah, it was the most forgetful derby ever. So it wouldn't shock me if United did get a result just because of the nature of the beast with United and the derby and all the rest of it. However, I have to be logical about it more than just passionate and have my rose-tinted glasses on, my red-tinted glasses. And I think you're going to play against a team that's well-drilled, knows each other, knows the manager. Pepper, as always, will want to get a win. I know he wants to win every game, but he'll especially want to get a win at Old Trafford. You're still in the hunt for the title. And this is one of those games where, even though United have been quite poor, especially at Old Trafford, it's a massive win. If you get a win against United at Old Trafford, Manchester Derby, it puts more pressure on you guys for Arsenal. And gives everyone, you know, the fans and everything else, a lift. So, yeah, my heart is saying United can do something, but my head is saying that all sort of logical predictions point to a City win.
Mm. Well, go on then. Let's have. Are you going heart or head for score prediction?
I'm gonna go with my heart. You know me too well, Dave. Come on, when have I ever done anything sensible and logical? Me and you've been chatting for years.
Best, right, Mike.
You know me. I'm gonna keep doing what I do. I'll go down with my ship. I'll go for a United win, and it's purely my heart. If you're asking for evidence, forget it. This is just, well, you know, everyone's writing us off and I can understand why. It's a derby. Anything can happen. All those cliches. I'll just go for a United win. And I don't listen. If we got a win, I don't care if it's VAR inspired. I will take it. I'll take a, you know, a dodgy penalty. I don't care. And to be honest with you, I know this is proper sort of defeatist, but even a draw, I think, would be a positive result for Manchester United, because it'd be, you know, a draw against arguably the best team in the league. I know Arsenal are top, but let's be frank, City, there's every chance City end up winning this league. So I think even a draw in your first game as manager for Michael Carrick would be a good result. I'll go 2-1. We're never going to keep a clean sheet. Even I can't be that deluded. But we can score goals. We do score goals. The trouble is we concede loads of them.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was Jay Mossishead from the Stretford Paddock. Okay, Higgy, real talk now. United are terrible. They're spiralling again. They were more than willing to open up their training ground to Exeter last week to help them mastermind a victory over City. And what happened, I mean, I don't know if Exeter took them up on the offer, but it'd be even funnier if they did, given it was City's record victory in however many years. Given all of that, how are City going to mess this one up then?
Well, they're going to lose 2-0. I don't know. I mean, there is that danger in it that they are a bit of a more, I guess, intimidating prospect in the current situation. The wounded tiger isn't really right, is it? Rat. The wounded rat is more.
That sounds like a pub from like a Simon Pegg film.
just popping down the wounded rat for a pint of brown. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the wounded, you know, to insert verminous creature of your own choosing, is more dangerous than just a casually bimbling United, as they kind of were with, I can't keep up. What was the guy called? Amarim. Rhymes with what's going on there. I don't know. We're not going to mess it up, are we?
That was the heart of my question, mate. I wasn't seriously suggesting it, but I was also leaving the door open to that possibility.
Because
Manchester Derby, we don't really know what.
Instead of answering that, I just taught myself in a circle and asked you it back. How unprofessional. not that I'm a professional, but there we go. Yeah, I don't think we'll mess it up. I do think that if we play a young back line and they tear into us with the crowd being as vocal as they can be, then they might cause us a few problems. But I think overall we should win that game, which is just it feels like a jinx just saying it. I hate derbies. I hate the feeling right up until the final whistle's blown and we've got 3 points or, you know, whatever win it might be. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they score first, but I think we will win the game. I just think we've got too much for them. If we don't beat United, then at the moment, the way they are, then, you know, we don't deserve to be in contention for the league, really.
We didn't really talk about individuals at the start of the show, Dom, and that was intentional. So where would you like to go? Because Higgy mentioned the young back four. We've also not really touched on the way the attack is at the moment. Which end of the pitch would you like to go to?
Let's go young back four.
Young back four, because Max Alain and Abdoukadir Kusunov have been the defensive pair.
That's a good quiz.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah.
No quizzes this week, I can
you
promise you that.
You've snuck one in there, have you?
Yeah, no, I haven't. Guardiola and Diaz, obviously, with the settled centre-back pairing, and O'Reilly and Nunes with the settled full-back pairing. What do you make of the defence at the moment? Because if you'd have said, going into the derby kind of 6 weeks ago, that your back four would be a guy that you'd recalled from Watford, Kusunov, who's barely played this season, and then Nunes and O'Reilly as your fullbacks as normal, you'd have kind of gone, "Oh, that's a bit dodgy."
Yeah, it's reminded me a bit of in the 100-point season. Like one of the great performances in that, for my money, was when they battered Tottenham 4-1 at home. Could have been a lot more. It was just after the
should
thing
have been
that
10.
Happened. Yes, very much so. What was the date? I think it was December. Should have scored 12.
Yeah. No, Tottenham would have had to score 12 for that one. We don't want that.
Oh, right. Okay, cool. Good job we're not doing a quiz based on that. But they were amazing that day. So many bits of the performance, brilliant. City's back four that day was Kyle Walker, Nicolas Otamendi, Elokim Mangala and Fabian Delph.
Oh, now, yes.
At what point would you have gone, that's a brilliant back four?
Whereas
with this, just in the space for a couple of weeks, it's gone from, oh God, Diaz is out for 6 weeks. Need to get Mark Gay in. Now it's like, well, Diaz is out for only a month, 3 or 4 weeks now. And we've got the boy wondering, who looks, Max Lane looks absolutely to the manner born. It's like a lone stint that seems to have worked very, very well for a City youngster, which hasn't happened often, ever.
Let's not get too carried away.
Oh, no? Oh.
Well, I mean, we do this, don't we? If someone doesn't settle in straight away, everyone, I'm not saying you, because you're an esteemed journalist with a balanced view and a valued opinion. But like, as a fan base, we do tend to fly off the handle a bit, and it can take like half a season of not being brilliant and people say people are shit, and then they turn into Ballon d'Or winners, for instance. So on the flip side of that, you know, he's had two very good games. I mean, you don't. I hope you're not eating your words after he totally flunks the derby and we lose 4-0.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, this whole conversation could sort of make mugs of all of us, because, like, I mean, to think about Kusunov as well. It seems that in the popular imagination, and I understand this, because like his first 10 minutes against Chelsea was so like car crash bad. Like people that watch City casually or even commentators, it's still like, oh, he's got a mistake in him. Whereas, I mean, he's been pretty much flawless since he's come back in. And he was very good for most of the time he was called upon last season after that sort of colossally bad debut. So, yeah, I think it looks in a great place with you. You've got like Alain looks like an absolute Rolls Royce on the ball.
He does.
He's clearly done a bit of man's football in the championship. So I saw this thing that he's won 13 out of 14 duels or something. And I reckon the one he wouldn't have
man's
won.
Man's a dueler.
Yeah, exactly. Pa-pow. sorry.
Am I going to clip that video up? Am I going to clip it up? I don't know. We'll find out.
Works really well on audio, that, doesn't it? I imagine the one he didn't win was when Brighton were pumping balls towards Ruta in that game, just to try and sort of see if the kid had what he had about him. The answer was a lot. But the same token, if, as Higgy says, I mean, and I'm talking of what people and team do and don't have in them, I mean, I'm not sure if United have the big Derby Day push early on to like get the crowd going. Because remember last year when Garnacho won that free kick in the first minute and then nothing happened whatsoever. But I can definitely see, obviously, we're having this conversation now. There's definitely a world where United race into an early Derby Day lead and all of a sudden it looks again like two raw young lads at centre-back and two midfielders at full-back. But right now, because of the way everything else seems to be working pretty well in the team, it's something I think people are more than happy with. Because, I mean, it doesn't look like Nathan Ake is going to make it, does it? I mean, he looked sort of not long for this world when he came to Newcastle. Bless him.
He's basically held together with elastoplast at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah.
What about eight Nuri?
Well, I was going to say that there's options, because the other side of this, Higgy, was Nico O'Reilly has looked quite tired in the last few weeks, and it's been good to give him some time off. And then obviously he had to do the job in holding midfield at Newcastle. There is the returning Ryan Aitnori, who could change the dynamic a little bit, though.
Yeah. Can I just say as well, it's like, this has got to be the cutest nickname in football, but I work with somebody who's a bit of a City fanatic, shout out to Track, but she goes to the game with someone, I think it's one of her family members, and her name for Aitnori is Auntie Nora. Oh, Auntie Nora's come on. I hope he has a good game. I just think that's ace. Sorry, a bit of an aside there. What was the question?
What impact could he have now that he's back?
Well, as well as setting the world of nickname lovers alight.
When he missed his connection, we were calling him Ryanair Nowhere.
Oh, Ryanair. No, I mean, that works on
no levels. Yeah.
Nearly two levels. That's great. No, I really like that. It's not as good as Auntie Nora. But no, that's really good. What was the question?
About what impact he could have. Yeah, yeah.
Football, Ron. Ooh, yeah. He looked, I've not seen him on the AFCON because I only worked out it was on Channel 4 about three quarters of the way through the competition, and then he just couldn't be arsed with it.
Wait, I didn't know it was on Channel 4. I mean, I've missed this entire, I could be watching it all this time.
Well, this is it, yeah. But
It's been on E4, which did allow me to make the quip, the big Aubameyang theory, which I was very happy with.
Well,
but Gabon got binned out in the group stage, so I've not been able to recycle that. So allow me to do it now.
Yeah,
Gabon got binned. That's difficult. Yeah. Anyway,
biggity bong.
Biggity bong. Eight Nuri. Right. Yes. I don't know what he's played in the AFCON.
What impact could he have?
Well, he could have a good impact. That second goal, that Cherki goal. I mean, he had a massive part in that. He's clearly linking up. His link-up play is clearly very good. I don't know if he's had much time with Cherki, but that seemed a natural connection straight away. That basically really whets the appetite, doesn't it, in terms of what he can offer. I think there are, or were, and will perhaps continue to be, time will tell, concerns over his defensive side. Hopefully United will be toothless enough not for that to be tested too much. But yeah, I'm all for, on the back of that Newcastle cameo, giving Nico a rest and letting him bomb on and dig in where appropriate. I think his impact could be massive, and what better opportunity to do so than Saturday.
Yeah. Dom, it's interesting because of, obviously with Ait Nouri's impact and what he can do from fullback, we were talking after the Club World Cup about whether Guardiola would choose to use him in the Cancelo sort of mould, where he's coming inside and stepping in that way, or whether he'll hold the width as the fullbacks have been doing a little bit more in the last couple of seasons. And the fact that he gives you those two options, when you think of one of the reasons why Guardiola hasn't really been able to rotate over the last 3 or 4 months has been that he didn't want to change the way the team was playing, and you couldn't ask Kucinov to do what Nunez does at fullback and all this sort of stuff. Like, Ait Nouri does give you those that opportunity to carry on doing what you're doing, but also do something a bit different if need be.
Yeah, I mean, I think in an ideal world, you'd have Ake or Guardiola fit when he's playing left back, just to sort of to cover all that side with a left footer, and he can then go and do all the things. Because obviously, he's clearly an absolute delight of a footballer in possession, and like the link up with Cherki was lovely. I liked on that goal how it underlined that still, despite, you know, well, Pep's going to coach it out of him, Cherki's first instinct appears to be always, well, I could do a back heel, and if I can't, we'll just work it out from there. But ideally, I'll do a back heel. Yeah, he's great, isn't he, Cherki, as well? Like, sort of, I've done the Pep thing here that you wanted to talk about Ait Nouri. I've decided to talk about a different player. But
well, we'll go to the top end of the pitch then, because
Silva, by the way, what a player!
Yeah. Because there's a lot to talk about the other end of the pitch as well, because one of the other problems of recent weeks has been injuries to the wide players has meant there's been no real rotation options there. Now you've got Semenyo in there, and obviously with Cherki, Foden, Reinders, like Bernardo, there are options for what Guardiola wants to do in that front three now.
No, it's really good. Semenyo, obviously. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if a couple of months from now we're sort of in a period of adjustment and he has a few games on the bench and he's working out all the small details, as Pep Guardiola would refer to them. But right now, they've just gone, this guy's absolutely on one at Bournemouth. Just chuck him in and keep on doing that. Really warmed the heart to see a City winger stealing in to score a tap-in, a la Raheem Sterling. That's been a while since that sort of goal's come around. And yeah, I think...
Me and Sam kind of landed on Chelsea away in the treble season. It's the last time we could remember it. Mahrez stepping in at the back post.
Yeah.
It should be a fundamental part of that position, shouldn't it? Like, just follow in.
Particularly in this team playing the style of football they do. Mm. But yeah, it's one of those things that's... January signings, you're often on a little bit of a hide into nothing. And certainly when City have gone into the market in the past, even last January when they were in such a mess, I think it's to their credit that the vast majority of those signings were made with the longer term in mind. But if you can get a guy who's like one of the form players in the league scoring a load of goals and stick him in and he keeps scoring a load of goals, then you know what I mean? It's
Good job, isn't it? Well done.
You can overcomplicate things at times, but yeah, one thing I've liked about Semenyo as well is he does seem to, I still think at times this season City have, it's been better, but they can, the press and out of possession, it can sometimes look a little bit soft. Obviously, it's not Haaland's most natural inclination. Doku can sort of seems to tune in and out on that stuff for me. I know Guardiola said in midweek that Semenyo, his work of the ball was better in the second half, but I think in generally he does look like a guy who's come from a side that has to play organised, intense football, but that does spend a lot of time without the ball, and is working from the front. Looks like it's certainly an uplift on what they've had there. So yeah, it's it couldn't have gone much better from his first week, really.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that in a second. But after that trip to Old Trafford, it's back to the Champions League on Tuesday and a very chilly trip to Bodo Glimt. I've been speaking to the journalist Ian Hoogland, who covers Glimt, starting with their situation right now.
Now it's between seasons. Bodo Glimt hasn't played a league game since the 1st of December, and they will play the first league game, the next league game, in the 15th of March. So it's a winter break now, and they start a new season in March.
Yeah, so how are things going at the moment? Because obviously this comes at a time where Manchester City are playing regularly and in the flow of things. I'm guessing Glimt are in the middle of kind of pre-season then.
Yeah, they had 3 weeks off after the game in Dortmund, and they started here. We are in Marbella now, and they are been here for one and a half weeks, played the two games. And we'll go home to Buda and to do the last preparation for the City game today. And so they are not in a match fit. They just played two games, as I said, and haven't come straight from a holiday, 3 weeks holiday.
Yeah. So how do things generally work then at this stage of the year? Because obviously, if they're not match fit yet, this could be a really difficult game.
Yeah, it could be, but the funny thing is that Bodø Glimt has been really good in the games in January. Last year they won one, draw one against Nice, and also the playoff games they played in February has been really good. So they've been actually quite good to find the form of season.
Yeah, and obviously last season, finished second in the table. How was form kind of coming into the final weeks of the season?
They were actually quite good. They had a really tough match program. That's why they lost the league. They had some injuries and they gave it away. But they took 70 points, and that would be enough to win the league almost every year. I think it's the fourth or fifth highest points ever in Norway, and still wasn't enough. So credits to Viking.
Yeah, what's the feeling around Glimt at the moment with kind of around the rest of Norway, because it's been quite a remarkable rise for them.
Yeah, it's the stadium at Etihad is much bigger than the whole city of Buda. It's 53,000 people in Buda, and the journey we had with Champions League, with the semi-finals, Europa League, just to come to the Conference League has been huge for the club. And to win the league four times, won the league ever before 2020. So the journey for us in Buda and for us, me as a journalist, to follow this team has been remarkable.
Yeah. Well, so what's been behind that, do you think?
Of course, Kjetil Knudsen, the head coach, what he's done has been amazing. And the club has been really... they found their way. They do it their own way. They don't listen to other clubs and don't see what other clubs done. They do what they think is right and don't listen to anybody. This is our way. We do it our way. And Kjetil Knudsen, the coach, he's way too good to be in Buda. But we are really happy to have him at Glimt.
Yeah. How will they approach the game then? You say they do things their own way. How does that kind of look on the pitch?
They will attack City. They will not come. I know I've seen a lot of City games, and of course they meet a lot of teams to put 10 people in defense and try to just to hold on. But Bodø Glimt will try to dominate the game. They do that with everybody. If they play Dortmund away, they try to keep the ball, play their own style. They will attack with a lot of people. They will try to find the weaknesses in the City teams. Not that there aren't very many in the team, but but they will try to dominate the game and play their own style, and that's attacking football.
Yeah. What will conditions be like? Because this is obviously the Arctic Circle. It's going to be cold.
It's going to be cold, yes. I just checked the weather forecast, and now it's probably -3 or -4 degrees. So not that bad. Last week in Bodø, it was -10 degrees and storm. So the temperature was, yeah, for the people who was at home, I luckily been in Marbella. So it was like, the feeling was -30. So, but I think the weather conditions will be actually quite good. There's no, on the forecast now, it's no snow, only -3 or -4 degrees. So I think it will be okay. And then, as you said, it's an artificial pitch. So the grass will be good.
Yeah. Yeah, but in terms of kind of style of play, then you say that they're likely to attack City. What do you think the coach will do to make sure that they are kind of safely set up and not vulnerable to what City will bring, but at the same time can get something out of the game?
I think that of course they will see what City are coming with, and as I heard, City will come with the full team. They will not rest any players, so. Of course, they will know everything about City's strengths offensively, and they need to take that in notice. But they always, even if they when they met Dortmund away, they always think about their own team first. What can we do to punish the other team? So I think that will be the main objective also this time for Bodø/Glimt. They are pretty naive in their thinking. They always think we can do something. We can punish the other team. So they take they think about what City will come with, but still they will be most of what Bodø/Glimt can do.
Yeah. And you mentioned preparations for the coming season and for the current Champions League season. What do you think the aims will be for this Champions League season for Glimt?
Of course, Glimt need to win against City, and they need to win the last game against Atletico Madrid to have any hope of going through to the playoffs. And of course, we don't think that will happen. So I think they use this year. They've learned a lot. They haven't been outplayed in any games. They should have beaten Tottenham. They could have beaten Juventus. They should have beaten Monaco. They could have get some points against Slavia Praha, more points. So I think they've learned a lot, and that's what they always think. Either we win, or then we learn. I think they will take this season and the 8 games they get in the Champions League for learning lessons to the summer when they will try to qualify again.
Yeah, has it been a difficult Champions League for them in that respect?
Yeah, of course it's been tough. They have 3 points. They could have some more points, but I spoke with the captain Patrick Berg, and he said we haven't been good enough. People say we could have we deserved more points. I don't think so. We haven't been good enough. So of course it's tough. It's a step up from the Europa League where they went to the semis, and of course going to the semis in the Europa League didn't do them any favors, because every team now knows that Bodø/Glimt is a good team, so they don't get anything for free anymore.
Yeah. In terms of the league as well, the league season you say starts in March. What will they be hoping for the coming season?
They, of course, everybody hopes to take back the gold medal to win the league again. But actually, in Bodø/Glimt, they never think about. We want to finish there. We want to do this. We want to. They always say they want to improve and make a good performance. That's the only thing objective they have. They only think about if they done a good game, then they're happy either way of the result. But of course, everybody wants to win. Of course, everybody wants to win the. You're not happy becoming second in the league. You want to win the league, but. They don't have the focus on the results on the way.
What will it be like for the City fans who are making the journey there? What's the town like?
It's a cozy town. Probably it will be windy and cold, but the people are really friendly. I know Bodø/Glimt has been when they went to Dortmund, they played a friendly game against the supporters. They will do the same in Madrid. They did the same again at home against Monaco. So if any City supporters who are coming wants to play a friendly game against the supporters, It will be possible, but so people are really friendly. It's a nice, cozy town. It will be dark almost all day because we are above the polar circle. So I think maybe the sun will be up from 11 to 2, maybe. So the rest of the day is dark. We always welcome people coming to Buda and try to have a good time.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll be a good game and a good time for the travelling fans. We have a charity bet coming up, Stian. So what would your score prediction for this game be? How do you think the game will go and what's your score prediction?
Oh, I'm the most negative guy ever. I never bet on Bodø/Glimt. I think they will lose. I think because City need a win to come top eight. And if Pep are bringing his best team. I know there's a lot of injuries and some problems there, but City are a better team than Bodø/Glimt. So I think City will come and do a great game and win 3-1. I hope, just hope Bodø/Glimt will score so we can get that the noise at the stadium.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Stian Høgland talking about Bodø/Glimt. Higgy, this is an interesting tie because they're in the middle of their pre-season. It's January. It's in the Arctic Circle on a plastic pitch. This might not be an easy game.
Yeah, it might not be. Under the lights, the northern lights, possibly. Might be interesting. The thing is, a plastic pitch.
Well, speaking to Stian, anybody who's making the trip, there's a good chance you'll see the northern lights.
That's why I said it. So I said that.
Yeah, he said he checked the forecast for us, and there's a strong chance that we'll be able to see them. So, yeah, fingers crossed.
That'd be exciting. Plastic pitch. I mean, they train a lot on plastic pitches, but I don't know at that temperature. I don't know if they do. You have a? Would you have a? I don't know if they've got like an under pitch heater that maintains a reasonable ground temperature, but it's skiddy at the best of time with a bit of dew on it, never mind sub-zero. So that could be something that they're far more used to, but given that it's pre-season, that'll be probably more of a leveler for them. Well, it's kind of a leveler for just one person, then it's not a level, is it? I think the fact that it's their pre-season could prove more of a factor than the pitch being a leveler. Does that make sense?
Stop saying leveler. Really know.
Jeez. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't expect us to come unstuck there. Although if you're not wearing gloves, might be an issue on the metal bits of the stand. I was reading up about Glimt, actually, just to try and drag myself into some kind of sensible discourse. And apparently they take huge yellow toothbrushes to matches. I mean, I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, they take huge yellow toothbrushes to the games. It's a tradition carrying on from the 1970s. I just don't know if we can really take a club serious if they're taking huge comedy yellow plastic items to games. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Does that mean? Oh god, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but we're going to. I've started the joke now, so we're going to go with it. Does that mean that the stadium will never have any plaques on it?
Oh my god!
Fair play. No, I'm here for that. That's good.
Sorry, I've completely derailed that.
I have just Googled this, and that is, yeah, it's just lads with massive toothbrushes. That's hilarious. Because I wonder then again if you'd been done by sort of a... Do you remember when City played Ammonia Nicosia?
Yeah.
So there was a thing, I think it ended up in The Guardian, of like talking about their fans used to like take potatoes into the ground and clap their shoes above their head. But this was very much... there was some sort of mad nonsense, but this was very much at the time of Wikipedia just been a bit of a wild west, and someone had just gone in and edited the wiki and put some mad nonsense in there in the hope that a publication might pick it up because City were playing this little known team. And sure,
or even
enough,
better, some of the fans read it and thought, shit, we should have been doing, like, get your potatoes, we're doing it.
Yeah. Get your spuds. Excellent. For the match. What?
Yeah. Yeah. Dom, we talked about the fringe players after Newcastle and Exeter. What do you see as in terms of balancing things at the moment now with the derby on Saturday and then Glimpse in the midweek? How do you see Guardiola balancing this week? Because as we've already said there, Lewis and Aitnori provide options, maybe not from the start, but from the bench. You've got the option to pick from Rodri or Nico, for instance, and then Cherki or Foden or Reinders. There's like, it feels like he has choices to make now, but it also doesn't feel like he's being railroaded into what he wants to do. It feels like he does actually have some choice.
It is funny how a couple of signings and a couple of injuries recovered can change it from, oh God, they've only got 12 players, to look at all these options. It's interesting when I was sort of working through this in my head of like who will start at the weekend and who the rotation options are. It's always been that big fallacy of, City, they've got two world-class players for every position. Thing is, at the minute, I'm not saying world-class, but he kind of has got two teams now, hasn't he? Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure part of him, it must stress him out to high heaven. Because, he's going to have to tell Divine Makassar he's not on the bench for Bodo and he'll be distraught. But, I mean, no, bad example. It's a big bench in the Champions League, isn't it? Everyone's on the bench in the Champions League. But, there are loads of those options. Like, say, if in the derby it is Rodri and Bernardo and Cherki, at Bodo it could be Nico Gonzalez, Reinders and Foden. I mean, yeah, it's,
nice options to have, aren't they?
One for the ruining football mob. Enjoy that.
Yeah.
Is it too late to suggest that they might be carrying those huge toothbrushes to fight off molar bears? Sorry, I just had to contribute to the pun farce. Yeah. I mean, regardless of who we play, come on, we can't be losing that.
Sorry, I've just Googled polar bears, and one of the first images that comes up on Google.
It's a toothbrush.
No, it's a polar bear just looking like you've caught it doing something it shouldn't be doing.
that's kind of their expression, though, isn't it? I think.
Well, they're one of the few predators to actively hunt humans, aren't they?
And listen, fair play.
Yeah,
yeah. We've been asking for it.
Yeah. The other thing, Higgy, I know you're not going to the game, but I do apologise about this, because if you were going, you could see the Northern Lights. And Stian was also telling me that the Glimt fans like to play a football match against the travelling fans. You'd have been up for that, wouldn't you?
I'd be bang up for it, mate. Definitely. Take my ice boots. I mean, what are you wearing there? Where do they play? Do they like organise it on an Astro or...?
I assume it's on an Astro and not like in an ice rink. I don't know what might be any difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be up for that.
Is that one of those stories around the old ballet on ice, that when City beat Spurs on like the frozen pitch and like the Malcolm Ellison, Joe Mercer and Ellison, great team. There's like one of like City did a big website piece on this a while ago, and one of like those endearing old football stories was Tony Buck was like, because he used to play in non-league. He said, you just remove the rubber bit off the studs you had then, so you'd run out with like just the nail coming out of your boot. It's like, yeah, that's a lovely old football story, but that sounds like hellishly dangerous. But maybe if you were playing in Glimt, maybe you'd have to take the Tony Buck approach and go out in nailed boots.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think it's my dad's favourite ever game, like the ballet on ice. I don't know why I'm telling you that.
What does your dad think of cup competitions? Does he prefer them to my nana did? So I don't know.
Big fan of winning them, I can say that on his behalf with the utmost confidence.
This is the conventional thing. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Anyway, yeah. Let's get some predictions. Back to form on the podcast last week. No correct scores. We stay on £280 for the season so far. William Hill has given us three £10 correct score singles, and the winnings are going to the Man City fans' food bank support group. United and Glimt to come. We heard from Jay that he's gone for a 2-1 United win. That's 11-1 and £110 if he's right. Dom, what are you having?
I've got 2-0, which I will now kick myself if it's 5-1 or 6-1, but I think... let's just get some money in the kitty.
Yeah, 10-1 if you're right. 100 quid, 10-1? So, yeah, 10-1. Higgy, over to you. What are you going for Old Trafford?
I've gone 3-2 City. I think I've had a bit of a visionary experience and imagined United scoring first or scoring three and then them getting a late one as we take the fourth to pedal.
Okay, well, 16-1 and 160 quid if you're right. So good luck on that. That takes us to Glimt. And Stian went for a 3-1 City win. That's 17-2 and £85. Dom, what's going to happen in the Arctic Circle for you?
I've gone 3-0.
3-0 is 9-1, 90 quid. Higgy?
I've gone for 4-1. To City, I should point out.
4-1 City is 12-1 and 120 quid if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, have a look at gambleaware.org. Time for a listener question. Blue Sky is the way to get in touch at bluemoonpodcast.com. You can also email us, contact at bluemoonpodcast.com. And the Instagram is always there. Just search for Blue Moon Podcast on there as well. John has been in touch on the emails to say, the way Max Alain has come in and performed, does that mean City don't need to go into the transfer market for a centre half, with the obvious point there, Dom, being that they could still be working on a deal to try and get Mark Gahey from Crystal Palace.
Yeah, I mean, while acknowledging the very good point Iggy made that we can get very carried away with young players and then a couple of weeks down the line, it's like, oh God, what's going on? But Alain does look very good. And I think there's also the fact that I don't think it takes Columbo to work out that Mark Gahey maybe has his heart set on going somewhere else.
Is that right? Because I don't know what's paper talk and what's not. I mean, you hear about the U-turn, you know, the Jamie Redknapp U-turn story for Semenyo. I just hoped that the stories of Gahey wanting to go Liverpool, Arsenal, whatever, were somewhere.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the gay stories, I think, are better sourced than bollocks Harry Redknapp has made up. So, but be that as it may, I think, and I know this, we are in a slightly different era with Hugo Viana, who does seem to be a little bit more reactive and open to the possibilities of the market than the Tiki Bergeristan used to be. But throughout this time, because let's be right, City are in a position where they can afford to do it. They're one of the most prestigious clubs to join. If there's a player who's having second thoughts about going elsewhere, it's like, well, fine, Alexis Sanchez, you go to Manchester United, you crack on. If Mark Gahey wants to still, because he was very close to Liverpool, he wants to go to Liverpool, wants to go to Arsenal, wants to sign a pre-contract with a big European club, cool. I think, because he would be a plug-in and play option for now. For like, you see, there is a bit of a leadership deficit without Diaz being there. But in many respects, Gahey looks like a perfect signing in terms of experience, Premier League ready, and he would fill that gap for Diaz for the meantime, and then could maybe play alongside him. I did see some speculation at Lincoln City with, I think it's I forget the player's name, but a lad who plays for Bologna. Now that would feel again like another Kucinov, and Kucinov has been looking great. But I think unless it's Mark Gahey to come in now, I think just signing another body when you've got the fact that Victor Hayes can come back from loan next year, Kucinov will kick on, Alain's look great. I think unless it's Mark Gahey and he wants to come and he's all in, then I think just crack on as you are.
The other kind of aspect to this, Higgy, as well, is you look at how City are stocked at centre-back right now, and there is a very strong chance that John Stones has already played his last game for City, that like he's probably going to leave at the end of the season, and like he's currently injured, he's probably might not get into the team again between now and then. You've got Nathan Ake, who is playing with an injury right now, and like Guardiola has acknowledged his fitness isn't reliable, and somebody who could
dressed as an injury,
somebody who could also leave at the end of the season, and that kind of like if you're gonna let those two go at the end of the season, they've kind of replaced one of them with Alain coming in. It does still leave a gap there, and if you were to go out there get Mark Gahey now or in the summer, then you've kind of done the replacing there, and you're kind of still stocked as you are right now.
Yeah. As Dom said, I can't really improve on what Dom's said because I agree with it wholeheartedly. It's not just going into the transfer market for a centre-half. If it's another centre-half where there's no... I mean, there's no guarantee with Gahey, but there kind of is compared to another. If it is him, then great. But because that's like very, very low risk... taking a risk in the transfer market does seem a little frivolous and not the sort of gamble I would expect us to make, but I would like us to get Gahey. And again, as Dom said, if he's wanting to come, then great. And if he isn't, just
so
have
be
to,
it.
Just to fill in my knowledge gap there, the defender from Bologna that I'm on about is John Lasumi, Colombia international, 27 years old. He always played this Bologna team that's got back in the Champions League, for the first time in like forever. They won the Coppa Italia. So, you know, is that Bologna team that Calafiori was in and guys like that. So, obviously, no doubt a good player, but it's not someone that... I think you've got to think about with signings with Guardiola. If they were,
is this like a Guardiola situation where it's kind of like we need to move heaven and earth to get this guy in? That's one thing, and everybody else is kind of secondary to that. And this feels like what like the lad from Bologna feels a lot more. This is an option, but maybe not.
He isn't like this is, you know, Guardiola. It was like consensus. This is one of the very best defenders in Europe for the next 10 years. Do that, and I think. Given how like Elaine has played, given by all accounts, Victor Hayes is playing well at Girona. I mean, that always works out well. Just look at Savinho. But no, there are enough people around that I think, unless it's Mark Gay now, you wait until the summer and do to go back to Harry Redknapp, you do a top player.
Yeah, and in further praise of Max Elaine, some of the kind of fan testimonials that I've read about him from Watford fans could not be more glowing. You know, they're talking about most nailed on future England player / captain they've ever seen in our lives. Thank you for the memories. Thanks, Max. We love you. Blah, blah. You know, it's just wall to wall superlatives in his praise. So, yeah, you know, although I was kind of erring caution about getting carried away, maybe that's fair enough.
Nothing wrong with being cautious, but yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's a friend of mine who's a Watford fan. When the news broke that City were considering bringing him back from loan to cover the injury problems, I just got a message with the link to that story and the words, like it wasn't even like anger or resignation. It was just kind of please don't do this.
Yeah, I was the first one to sort of take the piss and go, all right, well he's gonna have a great time watching Nico Gonzalez play at centre back, but. Clearly, Guardiola thinks a lot of him. Do you remember last season? There was like Guardiola was listing all the players who'd come back injured off international duty, and he went and Max Elaine with England under 20s, and it's like, what's he on about here now? But clearly, he's been on Guardiola's radar for a bit, and you talk about playing for England. I mean, let's get carried away. England aren't particularly deep in that position. If he ends up playing the rest of the season the way he's playing, strange things have happened that he's in a World Cup conversation, you know. So, yeah. He's changed the feel of things. Him and Kuznov have changed the feel of things a lot in a couple of weeks. And we acknowledge that there's games coming up at Old Trafford and Tottenham and Anfield that could change that conversation back. But four marks for them so far.
Yeah, four marks indeed. That is it for this episode of the Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much to my guests, Chris Higginbottom.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Dom Farrell.
Thank you very much.
There is a clip coming up in a moment of this week's Nostalgia Show. That was an edition of City Heaven, City Hell with me, Dan Burke and Barry Worthington from the Progress with Unity podcast discussing four games between City and Wigan Athletic. If you want to hear the full thing now, you can head on over to members.bloomandpodcast.com. I'll be back next week after the games with United and Glimt. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Greg just pushed it a little bit, but it made him stretch his foot round the ball and he curled it into that corner. I can't remember who the co-commentator was, but he was having a go at the City keeper saying he was out of position. It wasn't out of position. It was, you know, give us some credit. It was a brilliant goal.
Also on the goalkeeper, it was Claudio Bravo. So yeah,
like, it was shite goalkeeping, I think.
Yeah, a lot of players beat Claudio Bravo. It's not just Will Grigg.
He sort of went down to his knees before he dived, didn't he? Like, what are you doing? It was a good finish still, good but finish. I think he could have done a bit better.
The controversy from the City side of things here was it looked like Anthony Taylor had decided on a yellow card for Fabian Delph, and then it all kicked off and there was a little bit of extra thinking time for him, and it seems like in that extra thinking time he changed his mind from yellow to red.
Well, yeah, I think the right decision was made ultimately, to be honest. I think it would have been more a travesty if he'd not give a red card for that, really, because Delph absolutely flew in, didn't he? Like, what are you doing? Like, this was the year that they had the Amazon documentary, wasn't it? So there was a bit of like behind the scenes stuff that came out of this, of Pep going in at halftime and going, sit down, nobody talk.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.